Okay, thank you. So this is going to be a joint work with Stephen Cox and also with a couple of PhD students who will get mentioned as well. So we're having a bit of a theme of localized patterns at the moment. David Lloyd's talk, and next week Alan Chapney's. So I'm going to talk about a different aspect of localized patterns. I'm going to talk about conservation laws and how conservation laws lead to large-scale modes and how that leads to localized patterns. Applications for this. So we've seen various localized patterns so far in this program. So in the first one we had in August, you can see online, if you follow the web seminars links, there were talks in that first August workshop by Edward Knobloch and by Berwins and Rosazori on various aspects of pattern formation, including localized patterns. And since then, we've had talks by David Lloyd, and the Chapney and others on localized patterns. So it's a topic of some interest. And here are some examples, some specific examples of localized patterns are seen. So binary fluid convection, that was the example that Edgar talked about. Magneto convection is another example that I'll mention. Gas discharge experiments of Boeing, nonlinear optics, the experiments of Zorin, computer simulations by Firth, and another standard example giving localized patterns is the vibrated granular media. So here are a couple of examples. This is a computer simulation of convection in the vertical magnetic field. And this is fairly small amplitude convection near onset. And instead of seeing a regular pattern of convection cells, you see an amplitude modulated set of convection cells with strong convection in one region and weaker in other regions. And this was first noted by Nigel Weissier and one of his students. Particularly, they looked at the case where more strongly nonlinear solutions, where we really get very localized, just a single localized convection cell in the whole domain. Here are some of the gas discharge experiments. Berwin, so we can get a regular pattern of hexagons here, or we can get localized hexagons forming localized soft lines in this example here, or here we can get a patch of hexagons here and no pattern over here. So that's just a couple of examples. So this is one mechanism for describing localized patterns. This is a mechanism I'm not going to talk about. So lots of people have looked at this in various different ways. The idea is that if we have a pattern-forming PD such as the Swift-Hertzberg equation, critical. So we have a Swift-Hertzberg equation with a positive cubic term and a negative quintic term, then we can have a localized pattern that basically connects the two stable branches. So there are, if it's subcritical, we have two stable solutions, the zero solution and the regular pattern solution. And you can have a solution like this that connects those two. And you might think that this would not be an equilibrium. You might think that this front would generally either invade either to the left or to the right. You'd end up with either the flat solution or the equilibrium. In fact, there's an interval where that doesn't happen, and you get a kind of pinning effect. Localized patterns that can be stable in this sort of model. So here's an example of a stable localized pattern in the subcritical Swift-Hertzberg equation. And corresponding to the bifurcation diagram for that sort of pattern, as we heard about, for example, in David Lloyd's talk, is this sort of where so I mark the S branches that are stable, so we have a zero state that's stable here and then becomes unstable. And then we have our regular pattern branch, subcritically, that's this branch up here. We are stable here and then turns around and becomes stable at the low bifurcation. So this branch here will be stable. And then there's this other branch of solutions, and in fact, often there are two of these branches that sequence of saddle node bifurcations and the behavior that's known as snaking between in this region here where the other states are stable. And these are localized states that I showed on the previous slide in that subcritical model. There's a saddle node equation. So there's this pattern here where these localized solutions exist. But you might not see these localized solutions because they exist in a region where there are other states that are stable. So if you just do a typical experiment, if you just do a typical numerical simulation, starting from the control parameter, you would jump up when you get to this critical value of the parameter, you jump up to the stable solution here, and then if you crank the parameter down again, you will follow this periodic solution, and you might not see. Might then drop back down again at the saddle node bifurcation, not actually see any of these stable branches. So it might be that this mechanism is not quite so robust because we might typically see the other solutions as well as, or instead of, the localized solution.
I'm not quite sure I understand. So you say it may not be robust, but presumably it is robust if you find one and then change it. So it is robust.
Yes, it's robust in the sense that, yes, so I don't quite know, maybe David knows, how large the, it's not a precise question, how large is the basin of attraction of these solutions in relation to the basin of attraction of this solution and this solution?
If you start there, then you'll
Yes. So okay, they're robust in the sense that if you start near them and you hurry around, you'll think of them, of course. Yes. But there are many other solutions. So there are several of these solutions, so it's not clear which one you'll see. And there are also the zero solution and the uniform pattern solution. So I'm not going to talk about this mechanism. I'm going to talk about a different mechanism that doesn't require this high stability effect or this subcriticality. So this mechanism is sometimes referred to by Hermann Riekke as localization without stability. He has a paper with that title. Okay, so this mechanism involves conserved population laws. So let's imagine that we have a pattern forming problem for the time being in one space dimension. For some quantity of W and D, that has the usual properties. So a pattern-forming system that there's a reflection symmetry x goes to minus x, and that there's some uniform basic equilibrium state w equals 0. And let's suppose that w is a conserved quantity. So w is a conserved quantity, but what does that mean? That means the equation, if you try to write down the equation for w, it must have the conservation law form that dw by dt equals d by x of some flux. And corresponding to the integral, we get that d by dt of the integral of w of x is equal to 0, provided we've got some suitable boundary condition. So either theoretical boundary condition or no flux boundary condition, where no flux means that whatever this flux is zero on the boundaries, then the total amount of w in green is constant. So this fact that we have a derivative here. It's important when we think about the sorts of equations we can have for W. So if you think of writing down a linear equation for W, then the linear equation has all the derivatives because of this conservation law, and because we had a reflection symmetry, we can't just have dW by dt equals dW by dx because of the x reflection symmetry, so we must have at least two x derivatives in the equation for W. So all terms in a W or derivatives or even derivatives must have at least two x derivatives. So that means that when we analyze the stability of our basic state W equals 0 in the usual way, seek solutions like growing value lambda and spatial weight k, and we do the usual thing of supposing that we have a bifurcation parameter R. And there's a bifurcation at r equals 0 with wave number k equals 1. So this is the usual picture of pattern forming instability for r less than 0. we have a maximum that doesn't quite reach zero, but for R greater than zero, the maximum growth rate becomes positive, so we have an instability, this wave number, R equals zero. But we also have this other here, which comes from the fact that we must have two x derivatives in the equation, at least two x derivatives in every linear term in the W equation. And that means that the growth rate, the eigenvalue, will generally go towards order k squared as k goes to zero. And I'm assuming that this is minus k squared, so I'm assuming that this large scale moment is damped. Otherwise, it's a completely different problem. So these two modes here that I've drawn, they may be the same mode, so if we just write out the simple equation for one scalar quantity w, and this will join up this node here, or if we're talking about system equations, they will in general be separate modes, and these will cross over down here. But that doesn't particularly matter. All that matters is what happens in here.
Near
k equals 1, and near k equals 0, and near happens. So whether these connect up or not. Okay, so because of this conservation law, we have this large scale mode, often called a Goldstone mode, or sometimes called a soft mode. I think it's called a soft mode in my process review paper. That is, I'm never quite sure how to say it. It's a nearly neutral mode in the sense that the growth rate goes to zero as wave number goes to zero. So these large scale modes can arise in various contexts. So, for example, if you have an equation with some additional symmetry, in your symmetry such as Galilean symmetry, or symmetry W goes to W plus constant, then that also leads to the existence of these large-scale, nearly neutral nodes. So an example is any phase equation. Phases, the choice of the origin of your phase is arbitrary. Phase equation has this symmetry, and therefore phase equation always has the property that there's this neutral node as wave number goes to zero. And so when we have this large-scale Goldstone mode, we can't ignore it, we can ignore it, but if we do, we'll get the wrong answer. And so the generic conditions that are required for the usual Ginsburg-Landau protocol don't apply. So in order to get the Ginsburg-Landau equation as the modulation equation that describes behavior patterns near this point here. So when I give this talk to non-experts, I chat quite a bit about the Ginsburg-Landau equation, but I'm assuming we mostly know, most of us here know that the generic equation describing this sort of instability is the Ginsburg-Landau equation, provided that all other modes growth rates that are negative are bounded away from zero. So the presence of this mode means that the general theory, as for example in Ian Melbourne's paper, for deriving Ginsburg-Landau equation does not hold. Because that condition is that we require all other modes away from k equal 1 to have lambda less than some negative constant. And so in this context, we must couple the Ginsburg-Landau equation to an equation for this large-scale mode. Okay, this is the general form of the sort of coupled equations that we should get. So instead of making the usual Ginsburg-Landau, and that's W equals epsilon times some amplitude times e to the y x, we must include this large-scale mode, does not have any dependence on the small x scale. So these are the usual Ginsburg-Landau scalings. But the ansatz is to add in a large scale mode of order epsilon squared. So you can do the usual thing of saying what possible terms can we write down that are consistent with the symmetries of the equation. So the symmetry of the system is that we have this usual translation symmetry, which changes the phase of A, but doesn't change B. B is not influenced by changes in x. We have the reflection symmetry, which sends A to A star, flipped around these terms, and sends B to B. And we also have the fact that B is conserved. So I said W is conserved, so the integral of W is conserved. By, for example, the integral of W is zero. So this part here automatically integrates to zero. So the conservation law really affects this mode B. So the B itself must be in the form of a conservation law. And if you put all these together, you come up with these amplitude equations, generic amplitude equations. So this is the usual Ginsburg and Adam equation, this first three terms here. And then in general, the Ginsburg and Adam equation will be coupled to this half scale mode in a way like this. So I'm assuming here that the usual Ginsburg and Adam bifurcation is supercritical. Writing a minus sign there. I can choose one time to make this term minus A times B. So that's choosing the same as B, I can put a minus 1 into there. And then, in the equation for this half scale mode B, it must have the leading order term, linear term must be a set of the equation. And the leading coupling term between the pattern mode and the large scale mode must be of the form mod a squared xx. So it has to be a derivative term because it's a conservation law, and it has to be a second derivative because of this reflection symmetry, and it can depend on mod a squared because of this phase symmetry. So you can either derive these by including these asymptotic savings, or you can just write them down without scalings. In terms of the asymptotic scalings, this equation is order epsilon cubed from the usual scaling. Every term in the second equation is order epsilon to the power of 4. And there are two constants that we can't get rid of. So the way I've chosen to scale things is that everything in this first equation is a 1, and then we have two constants in the second equation. And I'm going to assume this constant here is positive, so that the B mode left to its own devices can just diffuse away at zero. But this coupling constant mu can have either sign. Okay, so I'm going to write these equations up to refer to them again. Okay, so that's a general form of the coupling equations between pattern mode and the large scale mode. Now, look at the stability of a basic pattern. So, a basic pattern, if we simplify the analysis, is suppose that we look at a pattern with wave number k equals 1. So, that's just the solution of these equations in which a equals 1 and b equals 0. And you add a perturbation, linearize, so little a and little b are small. Find the linear solution for these equations with growth rate lambda and a wave number little l for long wave perturbation. We get this quadratic equation defined by lambda, and we can see that there's potential instability when this constant mu is greater than sigma because of this sign of this term here. So it's sufficiently small l, so we can ignore that there. There's an instability at small l with mu is greater than sigma. So this is an amplitude-driven instability, so it's different from our usual sorts of instabilities of patterns. It's not like Eckhouse, for example, in a sense it's predominantly driven by the amplitude, not the phase of the pattern. So this is the simple analysis when we look at modes with wave number k equals 1. If you look at modes with wave number k not equal to 1, then the phase doesn't decouple and you get slightly more complicated equations for the stability. And what you find is that, of course, we have an Eckhouse stable band in the case where there's just purely when there's no coupling to the mean mode. We have an Eckhouse stable band, which is a parabola, and if mu is positive, what happens to the Eckhouse band is that it narrows as mu increases, and then when mu gets as large as sigma, the Eckhouse band disappears entirely, so there are then no stable patterns. Of course, if mu is negative, that's a stabilizing effect, so if mu is negative, then the Eckhouse band is wider. So then if we look at the nonlinear stability of nonlinear development of this instability at mu equals sigma, so we set mu equal to sigma plus some small perturbation delta squared times mu 2, we can find that if we work at this optimal wave number k equals 1, then the bifurcation is supercritical. So that's the secondary bifurcation from a regular pattern to an amplitude modulated pattern. Is supercritical, so we'd expect to see stable weakly modulated patterns near this point of sigma. For k not equal to 1, so for wave numbers slightly off the optimal wave number, then it can be subcritical, and we in general expect it to be subcritical because then it mixes up with the Eckhouse instability, and we know that the Eckhouse instability is subcritical. Slight complication is that when we work out the cubic coefficient in this pitchfork bifurcation that occurs to modulation, we find that the cubic coefficient scales as L squared, so L is our perturbation wave number. And this means that the modulation scales like 1 over, so the amplitude of this instability scales like 1 over L squared, which is large. So this tells us that what we'd expect to see is that once we cross this threshold, we would not just see only slightly modulated solutions, you'd rapidly see quite strongly modulated solutions. And this is really telling you that our scaling is not quite the right scaling in this limit, and Mike Proctor has written a paper where he's done a more complicated different scaling that brings in some higher order terms and is to a more difficult amplitude. But if we don't worry about that for the time being, just consider these equations here and look for nonlinear stationary solutions. If we look for a stationary solution of these two equations, we can integrate this equation twice, and integrating this equation twice, we get sigma b plus mu a squared must equal some constant. And because of the conservation law, we can specify that the mean of b is zero, so this constant of integration must be just mu times the mean a squared. And then we can use that to eliminate b, substitute that into there, and get a single equation for a. Now that has solutions that are in the form of sech, or if you want periodic solutions, we can write periodic solutions in terms of elliptic functions. And these are stable and represent a modulated pattern. And there's been a more rigorous analytical approach to understanding the nonlinear branches of solutions of proving what's stable and what's not stable by Norbury, Wayne Winter, and very recently by Vega. So this is what the amplitude modulated, so this is the envelope A for different, as a function of x, for different values of our parameter mu over sigma. So remember, the critical value is mu over sigma equals 1. So this first line here, A is a parameter in this elliptic function that corresponds to this periodic solution. So this first line here corresponds to a uniform state where mu is only just greater than 1, and in that case there's no instability because we're on a fixed domain. So being on a finite domain moves the threshold of instability slightly. And as we increase mu over sigma up to 1.06, we get these modulated solutions, and these are the stable solutions, and as mu increases, we get these strongly modulated solutions. Yes. Okay, so here's a nice toy partial differential equation which illustrates this sort of instability. So the sum in the big bracket here, is just the Schoenberg equation with a quadratic term. So wrapping up the Schoenberg equation, and then to make it into a conservation law, we just put two more derivatives outside with a minus sign. And then these two equations from this toy PDE, and we find that these coefficients, mu and sigma, that determine the stability, are picked by that. And so we expect to see an amplitude modulation of the pattern in this equation when s is greater than about 0.9, s being this quadratic coupling term in the equation. So here are some simulations of this PDE, so then these are at r equals 0.01, so quite close to offset, and we increase the parameter s, that's the quadratic term, and so at s equals 0.9 we have a stable regular pattern. As we increase s to 1, 1.1, 1.2, we see first of all an amplitude modulated pattern, and then at larger s we see more strongly localized pattern with regions of pattern here and pattern here. And these were all started independently with random initial conditions, so where the patch occurs in random. But there's no bistability here, so any simulation of that PDE at s equals 1.1 will give a solution that looks like this. Okay, so this is rather different from the subcritical mechanism for forming localized patterns, because this solution here, which looks like the zero state, cannot be the zero state, because our zero state is unstable because we're supercritical. So r is 0.01. So that means in the supercritical regime, the zero state is stable, and this solution here is not the zero state, it's a different uniform state. Because we had our because of the second derivative out in front, any uniform value of W, any value W equals constant, is a solution of this equation. And so we can get the solution connects to a uniform state that's not W equals zero. So when solving this, you have to specify, because of the conservation law, you have to specify in advance that the mean of W is zero. All of these are started from a random initial condition, but with the mean of W fixed to be zero. So we get these strongly modulated localized solutions in that toy partial differential equation. This is a 2D analog. So this is, again, a Schoenberg equation I put in slightly different, two different sorts of quadratic term in this example. In fact, we put various other quadratic terms in for various reasons. And again, so this is the Schoenberg equation with a del square term in front to introduce this conservation law. Because of these quadratic terms, we will generally expect to see hexagons. And for sufficiently large values of these parameters S and D, we get localized hexagons. So here's an example of a fairly regular lattice of hexagons with some patches where there's nothing. And again, this nothing here is not in fact a localized, it's not in fact a uniform state, W equals zero, or W equals some unlike zero constant, determined by the fact that overall the overall the integral of W is zero. Here's another model system involving conservation law in two dimensions. So this is a model that we derived with a PhD student, Sarah Ponikoff, for describing a Schmidt-Hernberg type of equation for convection in a magnetic field. So here, W represents the amplitude of convection, so this part is the usual Schmidt-Hernberg equation, but the Schmidt-Hernberg equation is coupled to an equation for the mean magnetic field strength, which is called H. And you can go through the process of deriving Schmidt-Hernberg models. In fact, again, I've missed out a few terms here, but this is the essence of the model. And this is a little bit similar to some of the other models involving Schmidt-Hernberg equations coupled to mean modes, but there's an important difference in that most of the other models involve the mode that is coupled to H is a pseudo-scalar, so this is coupled to a scalar quantity, so there's no curls in this example. And this model, unlike the previous one, has a W goes to minus W symmetry. So this equation is not dominated by hex spins, rolls or squares or whatever. And because of this coupling to this large scale mode H in this model, we can get instability to amplitude modulation and localized solutions in these sorts of models. So this is the corresponding amplitude equations, the analog of this equation in two dimensions. So if we just take the leading terms in the amplitude equations describing rolls and squares, so this is A1 represents the amplitude of rolls in particular alignment, A2 represents the amplitude of rolls in the other alignment, and B represents this mean mode here. So the analogue of these equations is this form here. So we have the usual equations describing rolls and squares involving A1 and A2. And then we have each of the A's is coupled to mean mode B, and then in the equation for B there are two types of coupling modes involving two different constants here, involving different sorts of coupling between the modes A, A1 and A2. So we can then analyse the stability of rolls to instability in the form of this large scale mode B. But rolls can have two different sorts of instabilities. So if we have rolls aligned in the x direction, for example, they can be modulated in the x direction, that's this one-dimensional instability that we saw before, or they can be modulated, amplitude modulated in the other direction, the y direction, and that occurs depending on this parameter, this coupling parameter here. So there are two different sorts of instabilities of convection rolls, either along the rolls or parallel to the rolls or transverse. Similarly, we can look at instabilities of squares, so a solution which A1 equals A2 corresponds to squares with B equals 0, and that's unstable to this large scale mode B if this condition is satisfied involving mu and mu. Okay, so now I've gone to a few applications of this sort of idea. So we have, of course, conservation laws very common in physics. So there are quite a few applications of this sort of theory describing modulated patterns and localized patterns. And these are the key ingredients that we need in order to get this sort of thing happening. So first of all, the key thing is we need a conservation law. And whenever you have a conservation law, you generically have this large-scale mode interacting with the finite wave number one mode. Another important fact is that we must have non-zero coupling between the pattern mode and the large-scale mode. So we've got to have this coupling term that I've scaled to minus one. In certain problems, it turns out that this is zero. Similarly, this term might be zero. So you need this strong coupling between the two modes. In some problems, you don't have that. The other thing is, in order to see this modulation instability, you need the correct sign of the coupling terms. So when things are scaled like this, we need to have this constant mu positive in order to be able to see this sort of instability. So if we have a physical problem with a conserved quantity and packet formation satisfying these conditions, then we might expect to see this type of modulation or instability. So the instability mechanism is quite simple and quite well known in various contexts. So here's a standard example of vibrated granular layer experiment. Idealized picture of how we might see localized solutions in this model, in this system, sorry. So suppose we have a tray of material and we're shaking it up and down. Think of a tray of sand or something. The experiments by Paul Umbenhauer, for example. So we need two key ingredients. So first of all, we have conservation of mass. So as long as we don't shake it up too vigorously and allow the grains of sand to fly out of the box, then the mass in the box is conserved. So that corresponds to a large-scale node, which will correspond to perhaps having a deeper layer over this side and a slightly shallower layer over this side. And generically, of course, the depth of the layer will affect the stability of the uniform state to pattern formation. So as we vibrate this system, suppose we're near to the critical value, let's suppose that we have over on the left a slightly deeper layer of sand and on the right a slightly shallower layer, then the shallower layer will be slightly easier to excite patterns on than the deeper layer, and so the shallower layer here will be unstable, we get pattern formation here, and on the left where we have the deeper layer it will be stable and there won't be any patterns formed. So that's this first point here, that the depth of the layer influences the stability of the uniform state. So that's this term in the equation here. So here B represents the depth of the layer locally, and so we have this suppression of the pattern, this minus AB term suppressing the pattern if the layer is deeper. So that's this first part here. And then to complete the feedback that creates the instability, we also need this deeper and shallower thing to be self-sustained, and to do that we have to have the fact that as these patterns form, these are not, this diagram is a bit misleading, in the granular layer experiment they're actually, as the patterns form you get grains of sand flying around and they're expelled from the region where the pattern is. So there's a vigorous chucking out of bits of sand from this pattern region, so they tend to get kicked out of this region and accumulate over here. So there's a self-sustaining feedback mechanism forming. Where we have a pattern, we get material that's expelled into this region here, which makes the layer more shallow, which increases its potential instability to pattern formation. So the second point is this term in the equation here. That. Suppose we have a strong pattern in this region here, so if we have a maximum of a pattern, that means the second derivative, if we have a maximum of the absolute pattern, then the second derivative of this will be negative, and so the dB by dt will be negative, so the depth of the layer will decrease. So that's the mechanism that's limited by, what is limited by diffusion, so if this gets too deep, then stuff will start to flow back into this region, of course, limited in general by nonlinear effects. So notice that this mechanism won't work in the infinite depth case, because the argument requires this the depth of the layer to influence the instability. So that's why I said we have to have this strong coupling. In the infinite depth case, you don't get this term here. So we expect to see these localized solutions more easily in shallower layers in these sorts of experiments. Okay, so here's a few examples of applications where these systems have actually been pain. So firstly, the example that I showed at the beginning of magnetic convection, where conservation of magnetic flux, and the mechanism here is basically the same as what I just talked about in the vibrating granular layer. Presence of magnetic field suppresses convection, and convection expels magnetic field. And we get these strongly localized solutions that John Blanchflower and other Weiss found, which are called convectons. And by looking at the small amplitude periodic convection and its instability, we can work out a condition on the magnetic diffusion coefficient, which says when we'd expect to see this sort of modulation instability in that problem. Another example is a paper by Alan Newell and Komarova in 2000 on sand waves and sand banks. So here again, the conserved quantity is conservation of mass. You know, if you go to the beach, you see little ripples on the little ripples in the sand, and so you have little ripples, and then you have larger sand banks, and the interaction of those two can be described by these two sorts of equations. So this paper derives this equation. And very recently, there's a very interesting paper by Mancebo and Vega, in fact, it's in a preprint, where they've done this calculation for viscous Faraday waves, which is quite a difficult calculation because you can't even solving a linear problem is a real headache. So they've done a weakly nonlinear calculation for viscous Faraday waves in a finite depth container, and they've managed to derive these equations describing the interaction of a Faraday wave pattern and a large scale mode. And therefore, they have a prediction for when you'd see localized patterns in Faraday waves. Here's another example, which I'll go through in a little bit more detail. So, convection in a rotating layer. In the idealized artificial case of stress-free boundaries. So, in this case, the corresponding conserved quantity is momentum, fluid flow along the rolls. So I'm going to talk purely about two-dimensional convection in a rotating layer. So we have some convection rolls. And the whole layer is rotating about a vertical axis. And I suppose we have these artificial stress-free boundary conditions above and below. And in that case, there is a large-scale mode that corresponds to a flow along the rolls. Which I'm not going to be able to draw very well, but we can imagine we have a fluid flow on large horizontal scale that is parallel to the rolls. So along the rolls there and then back out somewhere else. So that's the large scale mode in this example. So with stress-free boundary conditions, there is this conservation law for this velocity v, which is the velocity into the along the rolls. And so there's this large-scale neutral mode corresponding to that. So these equations may apply in this case. Now, of course, this is also true. This doesn't require rotation, this fact that there's this neutral large-scale mode. So in fact, this is also true in non-rotating convection. So in ordinary Benard convection with stress-free boundary conditions, there is also this neutral large-scale mode. But in that case, there's no coupling. So again, this term is zero. In fact, I think maybe both of these coupling terms are zero in that case. So in that case, the large scale mode is there, but it doesn't matter. Not coupled. But in the rotating case, it is coupled, because in rotating convection, the flow is not just as I've drawn it here. I need to draw a messier diagram. So along, associated with these convection rolls, there's a flow along these rolls, which is something like that due to the Coriolis force. And that flow is coupled in with this potential flow along the rolls. So to describe the sensitivity of rotating convection, we need to do the standard weakly nonlinear analysis, except that this term in red is density is included, which you wouldn't normally think to include. It's exactly how you'd normally do a weakly nonlinear, for example, deriving the Ginzburg-Landau equation for rotating convection, except that you include this large scale flow along the rolls and order epsilon turns out. So there's a parameter. This curly T here is the Taylor number that measures the strength of the rotation. And there is a marginal curve, critical Rayleigh number, critical heating strength depending on the rotation rate. And you can find the critical wave number, K, which is related by the Taylor number T in that way. And sparing all the details, you get solve some equations at order epsilon squared, and then solve some. Don't need to solve some equations at all of that sort. Here we just impose some solvability conditions on this mode here, the proportional e to I kx, and on this large scale mode that we introduced in red, large scale velocity along the rolls. And you end up with these equations where a1, a2, and a3, and a4 are some messy coefficients. So these are the equations describing the amplitude capital A of the convection, so that's the usual amplitude of convection, and B is the amplitude of this large-scale flow. And so if you make a trivial change of variable identifying, labelling dV by the x equal to B, and then differentiating this equation once with respect to x, you can see we get this system here. So, in this system here, we want convection model to be supercritical, so A3 greater than 0. That corresponds to this condition here, which is a relationship between P, which is the Prandtl number of the fluid, and the wave number K, which implicitly is related to the rotation rate. So this would be the optimum wave number depends on the rotation rate. So that's the condition for the convection model to be supercritical. And we have this condition relating to this coupling constant here, which tells us whether the rolls will be unstable. And that looks very similar to this. In fact, it's identical except for this factor of 3. So when we work out when this instability mechanism is going to occur, it's going to occur when this is true and this is true. So there's going to be a range of Prandtl numbers between this value and this value, under which there's a potential instability of the convection rolls. And that's the region of parameter space that we find. So this is the two parameters in the problem are the Prandtl number. That's the measure of the viscosity of the fluid. And the Taylor number, T, that's the rotation rate of the fluid. And in this region over here, to the left of the dotted line, the primary bifurcation to rolls is subcritical anyway, so we can't really say much. But in this region here, so these two lines, the equations on the previous page, are related by a factor of 3, or root 3 rather. In this region here, convection rolls are supercritical, but they're unstable to this modulation instability in this region here. So that's our rotating convection where there's a potential instability. Another example is vibrating granular layers, which is the picture I drew earlier. Now the good thing about vibrating granular layers is that no one can really agree what the right equations are. So you can just invent your own equations and they're as good as anybody else's. So,
This is certainly true.
So this is in a way it's bad from a theoretical viewpoint, but in a way it's good as well. So here are some nice example model equations for describing vibrating granular layers using Sindrick and Aronson. So the problem is that when you have these vibrating granular layer experiments, sometimes all the particles stick together in a clump. Sometimes they glide over each other like a fluid. Sometimes they leap around in the air like a gas. And there's no continuum model that will accurately describe all those sorts of behaviors. So, here this is a concocted, rather phenomenological model for describing some of the features of this vibration granular layer pattern formation. And so the vibration has been factored out and is incorporated in this term gamma psi star complex conjugate. And this models the subharmonic instability of the pattern. Psi is a complex parameter representing the amplitude of the pattern, and rho is the density, which of course is a conserved quantity, because we have everything on the right hand side here is a divergence. And so to make sense of this model, we need to specify an initial mean density rho zero that will be conserved for all time. And again, we can derive these amplitude equations from this model. And this model is pretty easy because you can see that these are they're almost already in this form. And this term looks a little bit like already looks a little bit like this term here. And this term is exactly this term here. Very convenient, so it's quite simple to derive these conditions and work out the conditions for when we'd expect to see localized patterns. And it turns out that in this simple model, if you look at the competition between rolls and squares, there's a very simple condition, which is that rolls are stable to squares if alpha times rho naught is less than beta. And this condition here is also the same condition for rolls to be stable for this modulation instability. But on the other hand, if alpha times rho naught is greater than beta, then squares are preferred over rolls if you just do kind of small box calculation of rolls versus squares, but they're also unstable to modulation. So the prediction from this is that when you see rolls, they will be stable to modulation, but whenever you see squares, they will always be unstable to modulation. Now this is a chapter of PhD thesis by David Winterbottom. And if you do numerical simulations of this model, you get some very nice modulated patterns. So this is looking at the instability of squares. So this is an initial condition of a pattern of squares. And we can see that the squares are becoming unstable to a fairly long wave modulational instability of their amplitude. And this is quite near to the instability and near to the threshold, so these are not very near onset, so these times are huge. And so as this instability progresses, we get progressively more and more strongly modulated solutions until you get these solutions that look a bit like furry caterpillars or something. Hermann Riemann calls these solutions worms in some of his papers.
You don't see that in the shaken experiment.
No. These are, you don't see.
Worms is a state of electric convection that Cuthbert has used for a different thing.
We must keep saying this is very much a toy model that models some of the physics, but not very much of it. This is another example of a highly localized state involving these strings of patterns. In this Aronson-Simic model, this parameter phi is what I said was alpha rho naught over beta. That needs to be greater than 1 to show this modulation stability. So this is a toy model, but it gives some interesting examples of pattern formation and modulation instability of patterns. Okay, so in summary, if we have a pattern formation problem that involves a conserved quantity, then associated with the conservation law, there's this neutral large-scale mode that you need to include, and you need to couple that in to the Ginzburg-Landau equation, and this is the generic system of equations that describes that near onset, that sort of interaction. And this coupling between the small-scale pattern and the large-scale neutral mode can destabilize regular patterns and lead to either amplitude modulated patterns or, in more extreme case, quite strongly localized patterns. And there are quite a few applications of this. So some convection problems can be described and instability can be explained this way, but some can't. So one example where it doesn't work is binary fluid convection. And various other sorts of double diffusive convection, like thermohaline convection, those problems, as I said, there's this coupling term that often turns out to be zero for certain reasons. So it can explain some sorts of localized patterns in convection problems. For example, in convection events, not so well for others, such as binary fluid convection, where there's a slightly different sort of large scale mode in describing the papers of Rieker. And we can also think of applying this to the models involving granular layers and fluid mechanics, such as the Faraday experiment.
I missed the bell, so I didn't hear the beginning. But it's actually not strictly true that there isn't a continuum model for the shaken granular layers. There is a model called it's a kind of Navier-Stokesy thing called the Jenkins-Richmond equations, which you can think of as Navier-Stokes with energy dissipation due to collisions built in. The only problem with them is they're absolutely stinking awful to think about. But they can be simulated, and they do recover the phenomena.
Right.
But the problem is exactly as you describe. You have to have a fluid equation that covers compressible fluids whose constituent relations change enormously between close-packed molecules dilated things and all that. And all that's been done. So in principle, you could start from those equations, and after a century, you could try to get somewhere.
Okay.
I encourage somebody to... Maybe it's not that hard, but... It's never been done. It could be done in principle. The other question I had was, and you mentioned this Mancebo and Vega paper, what's the relationship between the conserved quantity in that thing and the stuff that Edgar was talking about where you get acoustic streaming pushing around the mean depth, you know? Because there is a physical mechanism in Faraday for piling up fluid in one, mean amounts of fluid in one place. Relative to the other, which is just that any time you have a curved wave field, you get a kind of rectification effect, which is called acoustic streaming, which it just basically gives you a little flow that piles up fluid there. Is that the mechanism that they build in somehow?
I don't think I went to that talk about this. What sort of streaming flows?
I thought Edgar gave a talk about this.
Maybe right.
But any time you have a wave field,
yeah,
which you know has a sort of non-trivial amplitude structure, then and you have a non-linear medium like fluid mechanics, then you get effectively a rectification of the oscillatory part, which gives you a mean flow. This is called acoustic streaming. Anytime you have a sound field in a box, you also have a small non-oscillatory flow driven by that.
So the surface, small scale non-oscillatory flow.
No, large scale.
Right, because I need to talk about. The mechanism in the Faraday experiment in the Mancebo and Vega is really the same as I talked about in the granular medium.
So it's just because you have a total amount of fluid, it's constant.
Yeah, and stuff gets thrown out from where there's a strong factor.
Okay, well, I think the reason it gets thrown out is this.
Okay, maybe
the streaming.
Maybe the similar mechanism.
I had a question. When you drew in one of your diagrams the region where the walls become subcritical, presumably in that region the first mechanism you talked about becomes possible.
Yes.
So can you get both?
Yes.
Mechanisms?
And they so
it's the best.
Picture I drew is what typically happens. So this instability generally tends to come up against tends to look like this. So it lies between the up against the region where the original bifurcation is subcritical. So these unstable rolls in that region there will probably extend into the subcritical regime. And then there's a question of how this mechanism relates to the other mechanism, which is interesting, and that's what John Dawes is working out at this very moment, what the link is between this mechanism and the subcritical staking time mechanism.
Plenty more coffee to drink there.
Yeah.